Right, we're live. Here we are, streaming at the end of Civilization. I've got Endeavor, I've got Charlemagne, I've got Keith Woods. I'm a little bit rough around the edges tonight because I overdid it with the medicinal gin yesterday. But we're gonna make a go of it, and we're going to have a bit of a banter. There's really only one subject to get into. But how are you lads doing?
Pretty good, pretty good.
Yeah, I'm doing fine, all things considered. Still don't have coronavirus and just staying at home, really.
Yeah, not bad, not bad. Obligatory coronavirus joke.
I've kind of zoned out a little bit from all of the cycle of it, and I check the deaths each day to see if how it increases and stuff like that. But I've got worn out with the deluge of hot takes. And I kind of just sort of took a step back from it and tried to look at it like that, because of it, there's so many. I did a video on it, but there's so many different narratives, and all the different narratives contradict each other. And I saw a thing on Twitter the other day, and it was everybody was saying that they'd take nothing's happening, there's nothing to see here. But then somebody else popped up and they said, actually, the government's lying. That one person will say the government's lying and that nobody's actually got it. It's nothing to worry about. And then somebody else will pop up and say the government's lying and it's much, much worse. They're hiding all of the numbers and everything like that. Have you noticed all of this panic?
Yeah, and it's extremely hard to figure out what's really going on, which is why I've mostly avoided commenting on this as well. Endeavor actually made a pretty good point in the backstage regarding the reaction to this versus climate change that might elucidate things a little bit. Do you want to put that out there?
Yes. So I guess I'm also really I'm really timid in coming out with a take on coronavirus because I kind of, like Morgoth said, I really don't know what's true and what isn't. And secondly, I want to see how it plays out first. But what leads me to believe that this probably is a much more real threat than a lot of people might think is that I wanted to contrast this kind of with the climate change hysteria from last year, when you know, the whole Greta Thunberg, movement and whatever you want to call it. But with the climate change one, they're saying, you know, the sky was falling, and they never really did anything though. You know, it was just, you know, give us more power, give us this carbon tax. It was a lot of hysteria over very mundane action. But with the coronavirus, they were in denial up until it was too late. So up until 2 weeks ago, these Western governments were still in denial. The borders were still open. They were still having flights from Italy coming into Canada and America. And the response has been enormous. Like, you know, we have the strictest border laws we've ever seen in our lifetimes overnight. So there was a denial of the problem from the elites, but then the actual response was way more extreme than the climate change one, which leads me to believe that it actually is a real threat. But again, though, I think kind of my problem with the situation is that when you have a corrupt and treacherous elite, you don't know what's true. You don't know whether or not they're lying. You don't know whether or not you don't know whether or not they're trying to scare you in order to take more power, or whether they're underplaying it to hide a real crisis. And this is the problem we have today. No one knows what is real and what isn't anymore.
Yeah, I feel very much the same way. That kind of goes into the postmodern idea of simulation and simulacra, doesn't it? I was just going to say it's unusually difficult for me to really pierce through things this time. Usually it's, you can kind of see through the narratives, but things are just so all over the place. I think the one thing we can say for sure, though, that regardless of how serious the actual threat is, the neoliberal states are going to use this crisis to their greatest advantage possible and seize as much as they can out of it. And actually, to jump off of Endeavor's point a little bit, I did see you tweet about how the police are actually polluting lakes in England now in response to this, which kind of actually contradicts their environmentalism, which is really interesting. It seems like the governments are all over the place on this.
Yeah. What's your thoughts, Keith?
Yeah, I'd kind of echo Endeavor. I mean, my thought for something like this is, you know, I know there's skepticism about the state sort of seizing power or whatever, but I think, you know, the best way to look at states now is as administrators for techno capital for the elites. And so if they're taking decisions that are negatively affecting those elites, you know that this is a serious problem. And we're seeing states in the West are doing things that we would have thought would be impossible for them to even attempt a few months ago. I think it's a much simpler explanation rather than that it's some sort of globalist plot for a power grab to bring in martial law or whatever. I think it's more likely that they just do realize how serious this is and they're willing to do things they wouldn't normally do. But I mean, I think the interesting part of it is that it does discredit liberalism in the sense that Western states have all kind of declared a Schmittian state of exception now. They've shown that, you know, for all the talk of rights or this idea of sort of the us existing in this like state of sort of people above the state or the state as some sort of neutral arbiter, you see when a crisis like this happens that the liberal fantasies disappear and that, you know, none of these rights really mean anything. I mean, people talk about the fact that there's property rights enshrined in the law in the Constitution of Ireland, but you know, that was overnight that was gotten rid of, and our prime minister said, like, you know, those rights are subject to the common good. So I don't think I'm not saying that as in, you know, my response is to raise hell about the fact that they're breaching those rights, but it exposes kind of the liberal fantasy that they meant anything in the first place. And it's interesting then that you see people like Bill Gates and these globalist types. You know, in large part, the kind of neoliberal globalists wanted to go with a less statist approach and wanted a kind of either herd immunity or some kind of open borders cooperative solution. So I don't think it is in their interest the fact that states are having to declare this state of exception, because it does breach the entire liberal narrative around statecraft.
Yeah, and it really is to our advantage to have the state exerting its power like this and just cutting through the internationalist system like a hot knife through butter. It does a lot in favor of how we want the countries to be run in a general sense rather than just during a crisis. And I think we can really leverage this if we play our cards right.
And you know what? I think that the answer for us needs to be, now, I mean, we're all kind of burned out on the coronavirus news, but what I'd like to do is go back to the decisions made between January and early March, because that is where you're going to really see what caused this crisis. Because you see in January, I'll give you a few examples. In Florence, the mayor of Florence had a Hug a Chinese Person campaign to fight against racism. In Toronto, where my parents live, and they're now, you know, they're in their 60s, they're now in their house 24/7. They had a Asian food festival to promote these Asian restaurants that were losing business because of racism. And then what you can look at is the lack of travel bans from China, then from Italy, all the way up until early March. So, for example, another example I had from Canada was that when Trump had banned flights from mainland Europe from landing in America. And America's been hit harder than Canada, but for another about week or so, they were still coming in from to Canada from Italy, and there was very little border control at the airport to check people for coronavirus, and they were still in denial up until March 13th. That's like 2 weeks ago, in saying that, you know, closing the borders isn't going to work, and then lo and behold, they just shut it down entirely. Like, I never thought I'd live to see the day that Justin Trudeau literally bans all foreigners from entering Canada. But the lies were in place up until it was just too late. And, you know, maybe Morgoth would like to comment on the strategy, because you had mentioned it on Twitter, of the UK at the very beginning saying we need to get that 60% of the population needs to catch coronavirus so that we can get an immunity to it.
And then, yeah, and that was, so whatever happened to that? That was just dropped without any further notice. There was this, Boris Johnson went on the television and made this big song and dance about how we're going to let it just wash. This is the words that he used as well. We're just going to let it wash over the population. Imagine that for a strategy. There's like some toxic virus coming in from the East, which is either synthetic and man-made, if you want to be more conspiratorial, or it's because of the bat flu, the wet markets and all of this. And it enters your population, and then the leader of the country's, like, his strategy is to say, well, we're just going to let it wash over the population, in that language. I thought it was absolutely disgusting. And then they worked it out that somebody in the Tory party, in the inside, said, like, basically, it's just too bad if some old people die. They were only thinking about the damage that would be done to the economy. And then you do get the people coming out, and they do kind of say, like, at the end of the day, if the economy crashes, more people will die than what probably would with who caught the virus. Like, that would be more damaging than actually the virus itself. Which, when I saw the shelves are all bare at the shops the other day, I kind of thought about that for a bit and thought maybe they had a point. I'm sure Keith wouldn't agree with that, though.
Although I will give Boris credit. At least he followed through on his strategy because he caught the virus.
I've been tuning into the updates he's been putting out every day, and I'm just flabbergasted every time at how ridiculous what the UK government is doing is. At least on the US side, you know, the president is trying to act out a somewhat sane strategy, at least, particularly in the beginning with Boris just saying the strategy was to literally get everyone infected. That was just mind-blowing. It's
the situation in Italy was already getting hairy by that point. But the problem is that they're running out of infrastructure to deal with it. I don't know the ins and outs of it. I'm not a doctor, but it seems like what the problem is that countries are running out of medical supplies to deal with it. And I think that one of the reasons that Germany has a much lower death rate is that they have much more hospital beds. They have, I think it was 8 per thousand, whereas Italy only had like 3.4 or something like that. And the US had like, I think, 2.7. I don't know the exact numbers, but Germany has much more infrastructure in place to deal with a crisis like this. But Italy is basically running out of hospital beds. Like, you see, there was a video from Spain today that there's people literally lying on the floor in the hospital because they have no beds. And how could you possibly come up with the idea that we need to infect 60% of the population of the country with this, when you already have like in the tens of thousands, you're running out of supplies, you're talking 60% of the country. It's just like, how does a G7 a government, one of a member of the UN Security Council, come out with that strategy? I mean, it's just mind blowing.
What's interesting is when Italy got into a crisis in terms of its medical supplies, it looked to China rather than the US, and China sent a team of doctors and face masks. And same, even smaller states like Serbia basically completely ran out of masks, and China completely came to rescue with aid packages and, you know, mass shipments of various medical supplies. And, you know, the Serbs are celebrating how great the Chinese are now. But it's kind of funny, that shift. I mean, would anyone have thought of looking to the United States to provide aid for this crisis? I mean, I think people are looking at the US now, wondering if they're going to be able to provide medical supplies for themselves. I mean, what is it? Trump was on Twitter demanding that Ford turn their factory into producing ventilators. So it kind of shows that shift as well. I mean, the US has been so long moving its manufacturing base over to China. You see, in a crisis like this, you know, you see what that's worth. Because, I mean, I think the US is going to have the most number of deaths and the most number of infections by a long, long way. I think it'll be twice whoever's next behind them. And I think it is because of, you know, all of the things we talk about, the loss of manufacturing, the multiculturalism, you know, the lack of trust in the state, the fact that, you know, the US is sending people back to work now to get the GDP up, you know, the influence that financiers have in the US, the fact that the US is basically running the interests of financial elites. And, you know, in a crisis like this, they're going to suffer for it. And you look at the Asian states. I mean, whatever people want to say about China, I know people say the figures in China are fake, but even if you look at somewhere like Singapore or South Korea, they've dealt with it better than anyone. And they did that because they have, well, maybe not in Singapore's case, but, you know, they have homogenous populations and they have a strong state, and they just got on top of it. They put money into tests and into quarantine and infected people, and it's been more or less dealt with. And then you see how impotent liberal states are in trying to deal with this. I mean, I don't think it would have ever even been considered in a state like Japan or South Korea that there'd be a debate over, should we let 60% of the population get infected and get herd immunity, or should we deal with this as best we can using force to say it? That wouldn't even be a question in one of these eastern states. But that's the division that's been sold by liberalism in our own countries.
I think it's a much tougher sell, because one of the trade-offs that you have with them, when you have an authoritarian state and it's right out there in the open, it does have more of a duty towards its population than in a liberal state, I think, because then there's no other point to it except for to keep the people safe, even if it's brutal and harsh sometimes. And the liberal states seem to be really confused about how to do it, whether the state's going to be overbearing or the state's going to go too far, and the population are going to be divided along lines about how far the state goes, let alone the whole multicultural thing. And then when your power's like straight out in front, it's everybody knows where they stand, and they may not like being, was it, welded into their apartments in China or whatever, but they haven't got much choice about it, and everybody knows where they are. I mean, one of the things that I think is interesting, did you see the pictures of in India where they had these wooden batons and they were just smacking people across the back of the head who were out on the streets? And then you look at what happens in England is that they have these drones out in the Peak District. So you're out walking your dogs in the hills, and then there's a police drone, and then that goes on social media. So instead of having the sort of crack across the back of the head and it's right out there in the open, you've got this passive aggressive, what do they call it, a panopticon approach, where everybody polices themselves because you feel like you're being watched all of the time. And I've often thought maybe I'd rather just have the baton across the back of the head than the kind of mind-bending, suffocating feeling that you're being watched all of the time, which was the whole point of that drone. What's going on in Britain in general, actually? They've got people ringing up, snitching on their neighbours and stuff like that. It's I don't like it. I really, there's something dishonest about it.
Yeah, this kind of gets into the Moldbugian concept of formalism in some ways. You have this problem in the United States where, you know, the Democrats are blaming the Republicans and vice versa, where in a state like China, there's simply no option for that. So as he would point out, power and responsibility are really the same thing. And in China, everyone knows who's responsible for taking care of things. And if things go wrong, the population knows exactly which people are responsible. Where in the United States, Britain, and other Western countries, there's really no way to point to any specific individual or even group that's truly responsible for anything, because there's this built-in mechanism to just deflect blame onto each other in this endless cycle. So in some sense, it is, you know, it's very frustrating to have this constant psychological pressure on you of being watched when the power is dispersed throughout the society instead of coming directly at you in the back of the head with a stick, so to say.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I thought that back in January, I'll give you credit, Morgoth. I think you were pretty much correct that about what the potential dangers to globalism for that a virus like this really poses, because it seems like it's the entire globalist system that just has been so efficient at facilitating the spread of the virus, albeit unintentionally. But, you know, the businesses, the governments, the policies, or the culture is all in place in which a virus like this can get from China to Northern Italy to all of Europe to New York to the entire Western world, and have the entire thing on lockdown and the economy on the verge of collapse. Because then, you know, the problem you have is all the manufacturing is over in places like Vietnam and in Cambodia. You know, you can't get your, your sneakers over to America anymore because all the borders are shut. And it seems like the entire system really just facilitates the spread of a virus, just like, you know, it would facilitate, while it's working properly, the spread of, you know, McDonald's restaurants or Coca-Cola. But then, like, the virus perpetuates itself through that same kind of globalist system.
Yeah, I mean, I was quite proud of that video, and it wasn't one of me more popular ones, but the point that I made was that from our perspective, let's say like a dissident right perspective, when we look at the globalist system, it seems like this insurmountable enemy, that it's just so powerful and so overwhelming. Like, where do you even begin with it? And I mean, like, Keith's got into this before about the anti-fragility of it. I'd like to hear Keith on how, and what I got into was that, in actual fact, what the virus does is what makes globalism strong, its ability to move masses of people, goods and money all over the world, and relative freedom in the population. All of a sudden, that becomes a weakness of the globalist system. So, I mean, that you've mentioned this on that anti-fragility thing as well, Keith.
Yeah, well, you know, that ties into what Sherilyn was saying as well. You know, the fact that there's no one ever responsible for anything in the West. I mean, it was interesting. Our government were coming out a couple of weeks ago, and they were announcing all the crackdown measures. And they were prefacing everything by saying, there's nothing that the government can do to prevent the spread of a virus. And, you know, you kind of listen to them say that, and you're like, well, you know, you are doing things to prevent the spread of it. What else is the point of all of this? But they also do this, you know, at the time we had an economic crisis, they always prefaced any economic measure by saying that the government can't create jobs. And it's like the, you know, it's always the message of the neoliberal set. It's always sort of shifting responsibility away. And that is kind of what makes it so anti-fragile, because if you look at the responses, you know, everyone is kind of attacking phantasms. Like, everyone, you know, some people are attacking the Chinese Communist Party, and it's like everything is directed in all these various directions. But I mean, if we had something like an Asian model, where there was a strong state, where you knew who the ultimate decider was, and it was with state power, that's much easier to attack. But that's what makes sort of being a dissident in the West so difficult, is that the system has kind of spread its tentacles out in this way, where no one is ever really responsible for any decision.
Yes, and but one of the things we can take advantage of here is, I think Morgoth actually commented on this in a previous video. If you're familiar with how Napoleon won his battles via concentrating maximum force on a single weak point, I think we have a big opportunity here as people on the dissident right to really focus on things like immigration and attack these weakest points collectively in the system, because normies are going to be woken up to this to some extent, especially, and the really funny thing is too, I'm kind of gleeful in some ways, despite the incompetence of the government, to watch them use state power like this. You know, it's, we've had this thing with Trump trying to close borders for like 4 years now or something. And in a matter of weeks, it's a complete shutdown. And just watching what the state can do when it really wants to is kind of white pilling in a way, if we can actually convince people that this actually can be done to ends that serve the nationalist purpose.
And what's interesting is, I mean, I saw some figures out today. Boris Johnson and the Tory party have record high approval ratings. And, you know, when Trump announced the more serious lockdown measures, he's going back on them now. But when he announced them, his approval went way up. And you're seeing a direct correlation. Any state that's announcing sort of higher statist measures are getting like all-time high approval ratings. So there is kind of an appetite in people politically, you know, when there's a threat, to have a strong central authority and to have sort of collectivist measures. So I find it a bit baffling that the reaction of so many people on the right is to spend their time attacking that and trying to turn people against any sort of collective measures. Because I mean, like, this is a gift to nationalists. You know, it does, you know, all the solutions to it are sort of national socialist solutions. So, you know, we should be holding the state to account for not implementing those sooner and for not implementing them the right way, rather than this sort of conservative dead end of just constantly opposing power. I mean, you know, I don't see what the strategy is. I don't see how you're ever going to get power if your whole worldview is an aversion to power.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it's a tough point because there are so many things that the government are doing wrong. But I think in terms of actually establishing these nationalist lockdowns, that's absolutely the right thing to be doing. And one of the things here is, often once the government puts something in place, it's kind of difficult to have things roll back. That's kind of built into our system, really. And I'm kind of looking forward to the possibility of maybe keeping this sort of thing going long term, especially if this plague doesn't burn out. We can keep pushing on this more isolationist paradigm as opposed to internationalist to our advantage.
I mean, one thing that people are saying, though, is that when... what we have now is the state and multinationals, and somebody like Academic Agent would say that all of the small businesses are just being crushed by this. So it's the sort of the standard conservatives are pissed off, but at the same time we're getting into a situation where everybody who is self-employed are now sitting at home. Getting Boris books and then being forced to go to Tesco. The other night, we had this big thing where everybody went outside and clapped for the NHS. And I wonder, like, are we going to, like, go outside and clap for Tesco's and Morrison's because they're saving the nation? Is that where this is going? This is what makes me nervous, because it is a case that you've got the two pillars that are left standing are global homo multinationals and the state.
I mean, I think that one thing that would be interesting for me is that we know that the people in power are not on our side. So it is a bit concerning seeing them make these huge power grabs, because we know that once they take that power, they're going to be really reluctant to give it back. But at the same time, like what you guys have been saying, is we've kind of been calling for authoritarian action for years and years, and you know, we're now seeing it. So I think that definitely it definitely does a lot of damage to the entire liberal consensus, or the entire liberal notion that, you know, the state power can't be used, that it's against our values, that, you know, we respect people's rights and freedoms and stuff like that. Like that's going to take a huge hit after that. And it's going to be really interesting to see how they try to put that back together, because, you know, I think it's a turning point that I don't know how they can really go back from coronavirus. I don't know how they can really put the liberal system back together the way it was. I don't know how they can go back to saying, well, diversity is still our strength. You know, we still love globalism. We still are, you know, a nation of immigrants. After all of this, it's going to be, I've been saying for a few years, I think that they've lost a lot of steam in that narrative. And this is going to be a major blow to that. And I don't know how they put that back together afterwards. I mean, they're going to try to do it, but I don't know how you do that and have anyone actually believe it.
Especially if it goes on for months and months and months. You know, if people get accustomed to living like this and seeing that the society isn't falling to pieces, how are they going to convince them that we should go back to this internationalist system?
Yeah, I mean, the common criticism of, I guess, the argument we're laying out here is that, we're not necessarily opposed to state power, but the people in power are terrible. Why would you want to give the state any more power? And I understand that, but at the same time, I'd say to those people, what rights do you think you have that you're scared of losing? I mean, you can be thrown in jail in most countries in Europe for denying a historical event or even question a single detail about it. In the UK, people get thrown in jail because the police lip-read them saying a racist word at a football match. In the US, I mean, the FBI is dedicating itself to trying to throw every white nationalist in jail. So, I mean, you know, we know from our perspective that it's a fantasy that any of these rights apply to people like us. But yet, a lot of people in the movement still seem to be sort of laboring under this assumption that we're fighting off a tyrannical government with our Bill of Rights or a constitution or whatever. So, you know, I kind of say get the fantasy out of the way and pull back the curtain and let's have overt power rather than what we have now, which is much more sinister.
Mm-hmm. And it really is, like I said earlier, it's really interesting to see people's reactions to the full force of the state actually being employed. I think a lot of modern people simply don't have any conception of what that actually looks like when governments actually take severe action, employing everything they can actually bring to bear on a problem, especially in the UK, where people are being actually forced to stay inside to some degree. That's not really happening quite as much as in the US yet, but watching people's reaction to this is a really interesting phenomenon, because modern people just aren't used to having the government actually tell them what to do in a direct way.
And it's interesting because you see the cracks in the multicultural facade as well. So, you know, the drones flying over some white couple in the Peak District, and then they're like on the streets of Birmingham, you've got Muslims coming out and just gathering in their hundreds, going to a tennis court and praying because the mosque was closed down. And so you get this weird mix of like authoritarianism, which should be kind of neutral, but isn't, because we've also got the baggage of the multicultural state, which they need to take into account.
Yeah, it's a really interesting conundrum for us, because in principle, I like seeing the state in action like this. But at the same time, we know that the people in charge are so disgusting that we just want to inherently oppose every single thing they do. So I have a lot of conflicted feelings on this in general.
Endeavor?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say the same as Charlemagne. It's just that I'm really concerned about the power they're taking. But then, you know, I think one thing that Moldbug had said was that one of the powers that the cathedral has is the power of deflection. And Charlemagne was referring to that earlier, that they can kind of deflect the blame off to someone else. The Democrats can blame the Republicans. The Republicans can blame the Democrats. I think that with them kind of taking this this power on board, what I hope is that we can take it away. We can take the narrative away from, is it Trump's fault? Is it the Democrats' fault? Towards, is it a problem with the entire system? Because, you know, I'm seeing a lot of the boomers on my Facebook page, saying that, well, oh, Trump caused this in America. He's going to cause the coronavirus to, destroy New York State or something like that. But, you know, I think that the message you need to get through to them is that it's not the Democrats, it's not the Republicans, it's the entire system that's in place that allows this to happen. And I hope we can pull out of this is that a lot more broad critique of the entire globalist system, rather than, you know, just one like it's the left, it's the neoliberals, it's the corporations. It needs to be kind of a much more broad critique that we levy against them from the coronavirus, because kind of like I said, you know, there's you don't really know who to pin the blame on. You can't blame the governments entirely, the corporations or the media. It just seems like they're all to blame in a sense, because they are all part of the cathedral, if we want to use that phrase.
I saw a Trump from tweet yesterday, I think it was, where it was like an all caps boomer rant where he was like screaming at General Motors and Ford that they had to start and build, I don't know, it was like 100,000 ventilators or something like that. And they'd agreed to do it or something, and then they'd fallen back on it. They'd been a bit half-arsed about it. And so Trump was like screaming at them, and I thought that was interesting, because all of a sudden it's as if, I mean, Keith would probably have something to say on this, all of a sudden the state power is showing these corporations who are boss. Whereas normally it seems like in normal times these corporations just get to run riot, and it's as if they own the place. And that's largely how we would frame this over the last few years. And in actual fact, what we see in the case of the virus is where the state has to sort of bitch slap them to get these things done. Even though it was a bit cringe and all of the rest of it, there's still an important point being made there, I think.
Yeah, but at the same time, like, how weak is that he's the leader of the country is going on Twitter like shouting threats and block capitals. Like, there's serious weakness in that. I mean, in the case of the Chinese, you know, they could build multiple hospitals within a couple of weeks. They can just divert state power towards something like that. And, you know, if the Chinese decided that one of their mega corporations had to start building ventilators, that would happen. You know, China is much more sort of corporatist or state capitalist model. But, you know, you wonder, what could Trump make any of those corporations do anything like that beyond a tweet? I mean, you know, for all, there's great wealth and there's great billionaires in China, but they kind of work in tandem with the state. And so if the Chinese ever did need to sort of call on entrepreneurs or call on some big capital investment, they could do that fairly easily. But, you know, what connection does Jeff Bezos or someone have to the state of the US other than putting his money into subverting it and importing migrants to be cheap laborers for his corporation? So,
yeah,
you know, behind the bravado, there's a great weakness.
What would the reaction of the American government be if General Motors, the CEO, turned around and just said, no, it'll cost us too much money, we're not going to do it, and just said it straight back to central government that, no, we're not going to do it, it's unprofitable. Like, this, when this isn't a communist country, where this isn't socialist China, bro. And then, so the ball would be back in Trump's court. What eventually can they do? Because in China, they'd probably drag the CEO out onto the courtyard and shoot him through the back of the head, and then get somebody in who'd get the job done. But what would the Americans do? And this, you see, when you're faced with an existential crisis, the cracks of the liberal system really begin to show themselves.
Yeah, and you know, one thing I was wondering is, do we actually fear state power more than corporate power? And you know, maybe the UK might have a different perspective on this, but I guess from the perspective of North America, I actually fear the corporate power more than the state power. Because, you know, for example, in Canada, I think we only have had one person arrested for hate speech in the entire history of that being a law. I think it was one guy, I think about a year ago, was charged with hate speech and successfully convicted. But when you look at things like, and obviously this isn't going on now, but the diversity departments in all these corporations, like, this is much more draconian. You know, like, you make one racist tweet and your career is over thanks to these HR departments. But then with the state power, I mean, it's certainly not on our side, but it's nowhere nearly as ruthless against, you know, the white population as the corporate power is. And I do wonder, is that a trade-off that's actually beneficial to us, the state taking power over the corporations? Because it does seem like the corporations are much more ruthless in terms of enforcing the kind of anti-white agenda. But, you know, in the UK, of course, there's a lot more examples of the state actually being involved and using state power against that. So that's a question that's been on my mind a lot lately, is corporate power more tyrannical for us than state power?
I certainly concur with that for my part. I'm much more afraid of corporate power in the States than the state. I mean, at least nominally, we have some mechanisms by which on paper we can actually influence the state in the United States, whereas the corporations can really just do absolutely whatever they want. And it's really in their hands to just cut us off from the people who are listening right now and such if they simply decided to on a whim. And there's nothing the state could do about it. You know, Trump, I think, is discovering in his attempts to command the economy and such that he actually really can't, no matter how much he tries to exert control. Sort of like the Chinese are doing, he simply doesn't have the ability to actually bring the power of the state against corporations. And that's a really terrifying inversion of how government is supposed to work in the United States.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, like, the, you know, the leader of the Irish National Party, Justin Barrett, isn't allowed on Twitter. And, you know, I mean, we all know stories of how the social media giants have removed voice of people like ourselves. And, you know, it's one of those things, if Justin Barrett was banned by the Irish state from speaking publicly, obviously there'd be uproar about that. But it's just a slow grind of corporations influencing politics and taking away rights. And I mean, you know, like, Google has outright said that they want to make sure Trump isn't reelected in 2020. And, you know, whatever you think about Trump, that's obviously very sinister. And that's Google has more power to influence the American election by far than the Russian government. But look at the paranoia about the Russian involvement in elections and Russian meddling. And, you know, it is this problem of the soft power of corporations is completely ignored. And it's a really outdated political paradigm.
One thing about Trump in 2020 especially is, in 2016, he really served as a vector for concentrating force against the cathedral. And even though he didn't support some of these things directly, you know, the alt-right was able to push a lot of things more into the open through him. And I think a similar opportunity presents itself for us in 2020. We can use him as a sort of vector to concentrate our force, be minimal as it is, into American politics. I think the coronavirus is really going to take center stage in the 2020 election, and we need to figure out how to utilize that and Trump's campaign to try and push more of our ideas into the mainstream.
I think it'd be crazy to support Trump, though. I mean, if anyone wants to go down with that ship now, that is, you know, if you hit yourself to the Trump phenomenon now for the next few months, you're going down with a sinking ship, because it's going to be rough.
I wouldn't recommend that. I don't plan on doing any campaigning for Trump or anything like that. I mean, I'm pretty neutral on it. But at the same time, I think we can use what he's doing, his bully pulpit, so to speak, as a sort of a vector for us.
Has anybody been paying attention to how this is affecting the American election? Is it like what are the Dems saying about this?
Well, a lot of their primaries are actually on hold, and they're desperate to prevent that, actually, which is pretty interesting. They're trying to get the states to hold their primary elections now, as opposed to waiting until later. And I have a few ideas on why. I think part of it is they just don't want Biden to burn out and risk Sanders actually becoming the nominee, which I think is actually the preferable outcome for us, really, because that would be a huge nail in the coffin of the establishment, because they're obviously trying to do everything they can possible to prevent that from happening. Because what it will do is it will unleash the left onto the cathedral as a whole, I think. I think you saw this on the right. One of the things the Republican Party does is contain right-wing thought. But after Trump got elected, I think people started focusing on the problem of election less because it was actually won. And I think if Bernie actually wins in the primaries, the progressives and far leftists are really going to turn on the Democratic Party. And that would be very, very destructive to them, which I think would be actually good for us. And I think the other thing, too, is one of the reasons they're very afraid of coronavirus becoming the centerpiece of the election, because they know that the internationalist platform can't win on that paradigm. And that's what the Democrats are all about. So they're desperate to keep this issue out of the limelight, but I don't think they're going to be successful. So I think that's one of the reasons why the campaign is going to be really interesting in the next few months, because it's a biological rebuttal to everything that the left in the United States stands for.
It's a strange thing when you have these center-right cook parties, whether it's the Republicans or the Conservatives, who have to exert pressure on corporations, who they are at the end of the day. That's their donors. They are more in hock to them. I mean, I'm more familiar with the British situation than the American one. But, I mean, the idea, by the way, the idea of that Labour having to deal with this is the stuff of nightmares. But that said, someone like Jeremy Corbyn would have no qualms about just smashing the corporation in a time of emergency, just hamstringing the corporations with legislation and new rules and everything like that. That I do believe that, and I think Bernie Sanders would do that. But you know how they deal with it in other ways, and all with all of their diversity hires and stuff. Christ, that terrifies you. Just thinking about how Diane Abbott would be dealing with this as Home Secretary is the stuff of nightmares.
But when Trump was trying to introduce that stimulus package, the first time it was rejected because Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats tried to introduce all these diversity policies into it. They tried to sneak in things with like migrants and diversity quotas in corporations. And you even see at a time like this, they're still trying to cram, you know, the anti-white agenda into the coronavirus crisis. And I mean, they kind of have this major contradiction that, you know, it's a time of crisis, but at the same time, they know that they can't let their foot off the diversity bandwagon, because then if they do that, if they admit that for a brief moment that it's not the most important thing in the world, then the entire house of cards just comes crumbling down. So, you know, they're in this weird situation where they have this ideology that's just based on complete lies, but they need to even uphold it at a time like this.
Yeah, and I think that's why all that stuff was jammed into the bill, because their only way of getting these things through right now is to just try to force them in there or sneak them in there, essentially holding the entire U.S. economy at ransom to get their progressive principles in, because they know that there's no way any of this stuff can actually stand up to what's actually happening in the real world right now.
So one of the things that, just moving it along a little bit, I just wanted to touch on the conspiracy theory thing as well, because there's no way that anybody can prove one narrative or another. And I did a little outdoors video on this. And it is a bit of a headbuster, and it's because the statistics, I mean, Keith mentioned this in a video, even when the statistics being presented on the internet, you can just say, well, I don't believe the statistics. Where did the statistics come from? And it's as if we're in this like fluid reality where nothing can be proven, and everybody's theory cannot be proven to be any less or any worse, any better than the next person's, and it's just this tangled mess of narratives. And I find it a bit. I think it speaks specifically to the internet. It's as if empiricism has died, because even when the statistics are presented, nobody believes them, and they don't have to either.
Well, I think one thing here that sort of cuts through the raw numbers is if this really was an existential threat, I think at this point we would probably see China in an almost state of a collapse. So I think either the plague has to be not quite as bad as that it will take down your entire society, or at least it can be contained. I mean, it has to be one or the other at this point, because at the rate of infection with exponential growth, basically at least half of China would have been exposed at this point. So they've either contained it, or if half of their nation can be exposed, they can still survive it. I mean, there's no way China could hide its actual collapse with propaganda, right? So I think we do know that this isn't going to completely end the human race or end nations like China or the United States. It is something that we can actually get through, regardless of what you think of the numbers or whether or not you think, you know, China is concealing things. It seems obvious that they have to have things under control to some extent by now.
Well, we can get through it if we do it like China. I mean, they quarantined an entire city. They brought the full use of the state. You know, everyone, it's not long ago everyone was sharing these videos of how terrible the Chinese regime was because they were forcibly putting people into quarantine. So I mean, I don't think we'll ever see those kinds of measures in the West. So I think it's always going to be sort of half measures. I mean, I think the US surpassed 100,000 cases today, didn't they? So it's going to be far worse than China. And I mean, there's still, you know, there's people in the comments now saying it's just a flu. But I mean, I'm sorry, but you're wrong. Like any serious statistics, wherever you look for this, unless you're just outright saying, I don't believe anything anyone tells me, no matter what the source is, everything is saying that this is far worse than flu, both in terms of the level of transmission and the death rate. I mean, the death rate in the US is already 1.6-1.7%. And, you know, it's only been a few weeks. That's going to climb. And, you know, we know it's far more transmittable than the regular flu. But, you know, yet people are clinging to this. It's just a flu. And, yeah, I mean, I've debated with some of these people. But you realize at a certain point, you know, there are some people that have just sort of accepted a denial of empirical reality. Mm. And whatever, if you give them an academic source, they'll say, well, you know, the lab coats are the people that told us race isn't real, so I don't believe it. If you show them, I saw someone responded to, there was a video going around of like a newspaper in one of these towns in Lombardy with all the deaths, and someone was saying, well, they could have created all of these fake identities to fill up the newspapers. It kind of gets to a point where it's like, I mean, what can you do with these people? Like, I know this is probably pissing a lot of people off in the chat, but
I was just going to say,
yeah, but I mean, I'm seeing people like just prominent Irish figures, and I'm seeing, you know, this, it's like all this denial of everything. And then like, there's a bit of vaccine stuff thrown in there. And then there's, Hillary Clinton is somehow responsible and all this stuff. And it's just like, where is this ever going to go? Like, you're just kind of, you know, it's the old man screaming at the clouds. Like, you're just denying reality and, wishing that these bad people weren't in charge. But what's the end point for this?
Do you think that China locked down an entire province just for the lulz? I mean, how do you explain that? Yeah.
Or not only that, but like the people in power today, they're taking a huge bite. Like, they're losing billions and billions of dollars. And this, if anything, delegitimizes the system in which they have absolute power over. And if you want to get a bit more conspiratorial, just look at a certain state in the Middle East. It's still infected. Look at New York City. It's still infected. So it's not a certain group that seems to that's facilitating it. It does seem like it's a very real threat.
But what I find funny is the same people are saying that China didn't deal with this and they're hiding the numbers and it's actually way worse than they're saying. And at the same time, they're saying it's just a flu and it's no worse than a flu. Yeah, it's kind of like, well, pick one. Yeah. Is it no worse than a flu and the Chinese, it's under control in China? Or are the Chinese massively infected and can't get it under control and it's a threat? Because you can't really have both.
It's just the flu, bro. Woke. The government's lying about the numbers. It's much worse than what we're being told. I don't know which one it is. What is it? And at the end of the day, there's nothing you can do about it but sit in and read books and chill out and just see how it unfolds, because you're powerless anyway.
I'll say this. I had the swine flu back in 2009 when that was going around, and that was horrible. Easily the worst illness I've ever had. I had a close to dangerous fever to the point where, you know, your brain can suffer damage. It was like 104 or something, and if I hadn't gone to the doctor, I might have been, you know, permanently affected by that. And by all accounts, this is worse than swine flu, significantly. So my experience is telling me I should at least take this seriously and not just dismiss it as the flu, because I know there are things out there that are much worse than the flu. I mean, just today, my brother told me that someone who's a contractor at his work died from the coronavirus. Here we are, right? I don't see how you can just dismiss this as the flu at this point.
It is. So one of my mates has been really on edge about all this. And he's saying, yeah, he keeps sending me like screenshots of his, he's got like a normie Facebook account, and he keeps sending me screenshots of people who know people who've got it. But even then people will say, how do they know? Maybe they've just got a flu. They've just come down with a cold, and you get that, the breakdown of information. But there is, in small local newspapers, there are people dying, you know? Is coming close and closer, and that's what he's saying. Like, because he's been the one who's sort of it's the end of the world, I'm hunkering down, I've got a 20 kilo bag of rice, and I've been the one saying, all right, just calm down, we'll see how it plays out. And so he's bombarding me with like, it's in this village, it's in this town. Not all of these things are made up, and that's not all bullshit. It is coming close, like within 2 or 3 degrees of separation to people. I don't know what, like, with all the people who are denying it's a thing, well, how close does it have to get before they say, well, actually, I'm gonna drop all of these conspiracy theories that I've been peddling on the internet and actually start and take it seriously.
But another question for those people, and you know, some of them are in the chat going off, but a question for them is, let's say there was a virus, let's say this is fake, whatever, but what if in a few years' time there was a virus that came out of China that had a 10% death rate and it was massively contagious? What would your response be? Your response would be the exact same thing. You know, you'd deny any of the empirical data coming out about it. You'd deny the stuff on the news. You'd say the government lies. You'd say it's the government seizing power with martial law. You'd say you don't trust the lab coats. So, you know, that's a problem in your worldview. You've no way to deal with something like this because your response to anything, no matter what it is always going to be to oppose any state power and to just go into conspiratorial mindset and deny it. So, you know, to the people saying it's fake, well, even if it is fake, is that not a problem in your worldview that you have no heuristic, you've no method to ever deal with something like this, as is evidenced by exactly this case?
Yeah, very, very good points there. And with something like this, you have to, in some sense, overreact preemptively, or else it becomes too late. I don't really see any other option.
And, you know, it really speaks to the kind of the breakdown in narrative that we really have in the West that, you know, in the past, you would have had a dominant narrative, which actually would, you know, guide people through this. And, you know, they'd have an authority structure that they actually trust and they actually rely on. And, you know, I mean, it sounds authoritarian, but, you know, you get your truth from that power structure. I think that's kind of always been the case. You know, in the past, it would have been the church that you would have gotten your narrative through. You know, maybe in the Middle Ages, they would have told you that it was, when it was the Black Plague, they would have told you it's the might of God, you know, bearing down on you or something like that. But at least though, you actually had a narrative to actually believe in. But, you know, in kind of the postmodern era, that you don't even know what to believe. There really is no narrative that makes sense over it. And, yeah. Go ahead.
I was just, we live in this age where everybody's truth is just purely subjective. So that there isn't a sort of absolute truth. And when you get a crisis, I mean, you see, even before the coronavirus, you see these things popping up on pretty much every issue. One of the arguments that I used to get into on the blog all of the time was about terrorist attacks, where like some Islamic extremists would go off on one in Germany and like hack a few people with a machete or something, and then people would say that was like a false flag or whatever, and it was on every single one of them. And I just thought it was strange, because eventually you get to this point, and what they would do would say, is 9/11 an inside job? And I'd be saying, well, at least on that one. And then you see, if it was, then all of it flows that the government does do that to its citizens, and so it then logically follows that all of these other terrorist attacks can be inside jobs as well. But the problem that you have is that if you take it in the other direction, and you can say, yeah, okay, maybe 9/11 was an inside job, I can at least see that there was a lot at play about neocon policy in the Middle East. And what was the book called about the American century and stuff? It's been a while. But the problem is, because after all of these Islamic terrorist attacks, you end up in a weird situation where you have to concede that there's never actually been an Islamic terrorist attack in Europe. And that because after every one of them, it was called an inside job, false flag. So you end up in this weird situation where there's never actually been an Islamic terrorist attack in Europe, which I find to be absurd, because they do it elsewhere in the world, in Indonesia and across the Middle East, Pakistan. So for some reason, they do the Islamic extremists are active everywhere in the world except for Europe. And in Europe, it's our own governments who do it. What happens is the truth just seems to break down and under the strain of all of these different theories. Everything's theoretical. There's no evidence for anything.
Yeah, and the problem with this mindset is it just completely cripples your ability to act at all. I don't understand how anyone could actually justify any action if you effectively don't believe in anything. I think that's why Alex Jones is tolerated to some degree, because in some ways that type of mindset, it just prevents you from actually doing anything when you're unable to actually believe in any big events. You know, everything is just some sort of cover up. There's something going on behind the scenes. If you don't actually, you know, even if you don't, you know, I can't say 100% what the actual situation with the coronavirus is. I just have to use a best guess. But if you don't even go that far, I don't understand how you can do anything to deal with the problems that actually arise in the world.
Yeah, usually I think one good way of looking at it is, what would the reciprocity be against people calling out a conspiracy if it actually was a conspiracy? So, you know, if you like claim that this Islamic terrorist attack was a conspiracy or something like that, you know, you usually aren't, I mean, depending on who you blame it on, but if you say that, I don't know, it's to justify wars in the Middle East or something like that, because these neocons are, you know, racists who want to, you know, bomb brown people and take their oil or something like that. I mean, you're not going to get much pushback on that. But then, you know, when you're questioning certain other things with, say, demographics, then you actually will get them to crack down on you. So, you know, I think that because, you know, what I always used to think is that, you know, if Alex Jones is right about everything, why don't they throw him in jail? Why don't they why doesn't someone crack down on him if he's exposing the, you know, the globalists or whatever he's calling them? But then, you know, I think the best way to tell, you know, whether or not something is manufactured is, are they cracking down on people who are trying to blow the lid on it? And with the coronavirus, it doesn't make sense why it would be a conspiracy, because the people in power have nothing to gain from this and everything to lose. I mean, you can make the argument that they can gain the strong arm with power, as in they have kind of the ability to use power at their will, but at the same time, they just lose massive legitimacy from this. So like the legitimacy of the entire globalist system, it has taken possibly the biggest hit it ever has. And why would somebody in power today want to deliberately inflict a hit upon a system which they have enormous power over? It doesn't make sense to me. So to me, I think, in kind of like I mentioned at the beginning, you know, they were in denial until they had no choice but to accept the reality. That makes me think it actually is a real threat.
And when has the United States ever really needed to go to these levels to justify things? You know, did Woodrow Wilson plant a bomb on the Lusitania? No, he just let it be sunk. You know, did FDR secretly manufacture an entire air force of Japanese Zeros and fake the attack on Pearl Harbor? No, it just, you know, it was allowed to go through. I mean, same thing with 9/11 and such. I mean, since when has the United States ever needed to, you know, destroy some of its monumental skyscrapers to justify wars in the Middle East or anywhere? We do it all the time. I just don't see the need for these massive high level conspiracies, because governments just tend to do what they want regardless. And
yeah, it is. Like, they don't need a conspiracy because they don't give a shit what you think. They'll just do it anyway.
I mean, this is the paradox that a lot of postmodern theorists talked about, was that at once we have society becoming more and more rationalized, and everything is subject to rationalism and the sort of rational logic of techno-capital or whatever. But yet, the more that process goes on, the more irrational are the outcomes. And, you know, you see something like Twitter and Facebook or these great public spaces, but it leads to this mass irrationalism where, you know, everything is kind of subject to a clickbait approach. And I mean, you know, even much of the memes of 2016 that got Trump elected were very kind of not empirical as well. I mean, you know, there was so many conspiracies about Hillary and everything else. But it's this problem that I think something like between a third and half of Americans think that 9/11 was an inside job. Now, you'd think if you were trying to win people over to your worldview that having that kind of numbers would be phenomenal. You know, I mean, if 40% of people believed in the tenets of the alt-right, like, can you imagine? But yet, you know, half the people think that 9/11 was an inside job, but nothing really changes. I mean, what comes out of that? You know, the approach of everything is a conspiracy, and, you know, stuff about Clintons, and when there's no structure to this at all, when it is just the Alex Jones kind of screaming about globalists, but never really digging deeper into structures or a method of action or presenting an alternative, it is a dead end. And I don't think the system does have a problem with that. I mean, you see Hollywood and TV shows kind of parroting this meme all the time with the wacky conspiracies. It's fundamentally not really a threat to power. Not the conspiracies themselves, and look, a lot of conspiracies are true, but just that attitude, because it's always reacting against power. And, you know, I think as we've kind of discussed, you know, the problem isn't so much power so much as it is how it's been spread across the system to where no one is really accountable. And, you know, you have these technocratic overlords that aren't accountable to any one state, aren't accountable to any single institution. We don't know their names a lot of the time. It's very spread out. So this kind of conspiratorial blame the Clintons thing isn't really a threat to anybody.
Mm. I mean, I think it is that people are alienated from structures of power, and it does make sense. It does make perfect sense that it's an expression of powerlessness, that you look at the world and you realize you've got no... And we're living in the most extreme example of it now, where we've been literally confined to our homes, and we can't go out, we can't do anything. It is an interesting thing, and you can see how... The framing begins to be just anything goes, because everything seems fluid. So I think
the you know, that documentary Hypernormalization, Adam Curtis, at the start of that he gets into how Putin hired this like political strategist, and this guy started funding protests against Putin and like neo-Nazi rallies. And at the same time, he was funding opposition to those rallies. And then he was putting out publicly that the government was doing this. And the logic of that seems to make no sense. But because it's so absolutely incoherent, it leads to this kind of learned helplessness in people that makes them kind of placid against the central authority. So, I mean, you see how elites themselves kind of manipulate that mindset to maintain power.
Endeavor?
Well, yeah, I think that one of the problems is that you don't really have a counter narrative, because the one that we really have as a counter narrative is just completely incoherent. Some people think it's a conspiracy. Some people think they were incompetent. Some people think that, you know, there's just all different kinds of narratives, and that, you know, the state kind of tries to uphold a narrative. But then, you know, when you don't have a counter narrative to come back against it, they kind of have free reign to advance that one. And, you know, that's kind of what you have with the coronavirus. And, you know, that I think that we did kind of really miss a big opportunity, because, you know, I saw on Twitter a few weeks ago that someone had said that, you know, I don't mean to blame anyone here, but that had, you know, nationalists a decade ago, you know, got their act together, they would have had they would have had their one black swan moment to really stick the dagger in the establishment. And, you know, it would be our moment where we could say, you know, we were right. But, you know, we don't really have that, like, that solid counter narrative in place against the mainstream narrative. And kind of when you do have that mess of a narrative, that it's just, you know, a free for all, those in power essentially just have absolute power to just advance whatever they want to, because there's no coherent opposition, and there's no real coherent narrative to speak out against that. So yeah, I do think that the incoherence of kind of the entire situation just by default helps those in power, because it doesn't, you can't really conceptualize anything in opposition to that when it's just so unclear.
Yeah.
Charlemagne's in the backstage if you want to add him in there, Morgan.
Oh, right.
Hey, thanks.
Right. Oh, yeah, what I was going to say was that they are clamping down on... I deliberately didn't put any references to the virus and stuff in the title of this video, because they're clamping down on that, and you get a public health warning. There's people on Twitter and whatnot being shadow banned left, right, and center. So it's like... And again, it is the technocrats are well aware that this is a potential place where it can be misused by the people, as Charlemagne would say, outside of the cathedral. So they're acutely aware of it as being, they're feeling vulnerable. They're feeling vulnerable. And yeah, that's why on something like Twitter and on the YouTube, I'm going to be very careful about what I say, because they're like, and even YouTube even made that, made a post saying we're going to automate our moderation and a lot of people are going to get banned. And this is, so again, this is a sign that they're feeling vulnerable and exposed. And you can see it in the same way that I would advise everybody to be very careful if, let's say, there's a riot and there's a lot of stress and unrest in somewhere like London. I'd be very careful what you say about that, because it's all very well and good, you know, doing sarcastic posts about diversity and stuff when it's the normal stuff. We're red pilling the normies and all of that. I get it. But when the system's got its back up against the wall like this, they're going to come down on you like a ton of bricks.
And that thing Endeavor was talking about, you know, the need to have a coherent alternative worldview to be able to put it forward at a time like that, that's really important. But I think the biggest stumbling block to that is the fact that so many people in the right hitch themselves to conservatism and somehow see ourselves as aligned with conservatism. And I mean, the best example of that was, I think, especially in the US, they picked up on the fact that this was giving momentum to nationalists and with people with a worldview. And so they knew that they could easily kind of take advantage of that and get it under control by giving out this cheap kind of attack China thing, where Trump started calling it the Chinese virus. And then Ben Shapiro and Charlie Kirk and Nigel Farage and all these cooks were on Twitter then like bragging about how they called it the Chinese virus before anyone else. And they're like trying to outdo each other. And it's you see what a cheap dead end it is. And you see how, you know, the fact that so many people kind of fell for this and jumped in on the kind of like, because it was never, you know, the funny thing was they always prefaced it by saying we have nothing against the Chinese people. It's just the Chinese government. And so it became this attack on statism, whereas the actual opposite should be true. You know, the problem was the Chinese people. It was that it just came out of a wet market with this kind of this backward practice of how they treat animals. But, you know, the conservative narrative flips it on its head and it turns it into an attack on statism or on socialism or whatever, rather than on the actual source of it. And then, you know, you see nationalists that are just excited that they get to express some kind of soft xenophobia to Chinese. And so they jump right into the conservative narrative. So I don't know. I think it's a shame that people so easily fall for this stuff, like when it's so transparently cynical.
Redirecting energy away from, let's say, I mean, we haven't had that much of it in Britain, but in America, what they're doing is trying to redirect energy away from the establishment, away from the corporations, and then back onto the Chinese. But, you know, there's people in the chat saying it was their fault at the end of the day. It's a fine lane to walk.
I mean, it depends on your perspective of whether or not you think the virus was manufactured or if it's naturally occurring. I mean, the thing I get concerned about is that I see a lot of people kind of act out this sort of proto-neocon behavior where they really want to punish China for the virus seeming to happen from there. And I don't really think this is a very productive thing to be trying to do. I mean, China seems to be the most competent at actually containing this thing, and I don't really see why you should want to punish them just because it happened to spawn in a very populous area. I mean, that's just what happens. You know, most of the great plagues in history came out of Europe for a reason, because that's where the highest concentration of people were at the time. It's a natural occurrence, really. And
the funny thing is, you know, people like Molyneux are trying to use this to attack communism or whatever, but I mean, you know, I keep saying it literally started in a free market. Like, there was a lack of government regulation, the fact that they could have these markets where they sell wildlife and have them in these cramped conditions. So, I mean, look, people are pushing back on that as well. But the fact is, like, you can get excited about the fact that you get to express some hatred of Chinese people or whatever. But I mean, you're on the same side as Charlie Kirk and Ben Shapiro when you do that. So, you know, this tendency to just accept the red meat and to accept what any little crumb the conservative establishment will throw you if you get to do racism. I mean, you know, you can go on TV like Katie Hopkins does and demand Palestinians be genocided, or you can demand that the US glass Iran and bomb Tehran when it's standing up to Israel. But, you know, this is just cynically manipulated by conservatives. So I think we should have a stronger worldview than just sort of desperately hoping for a crumb from the table of conservatism like that.
Well, not only that, but it completely avoids the fact that the flights from China continued for months after the coronavirus had started. So if China is actually as bad as the neocons are claiming, why weren't the flights shut down in January? Why wasn't this all killed at the source? And I mean, that would have been what a nationalist probably would have done if they were in power, is, you know, shut as soon as the virus breaks out, you know, back in January or even possibly December, you shut down flights from the infected area. But as I mentioned at the beginning of the stream, what you saw is flights coming in from China, then Italy, and from all these infected areas up until the very last minute when it became a crisis, when it got out of hand and they had absolutely no choice but to shut it down.
And the funny thing is, China,
the
China banned flights into China there a few days ago. So we could end up in a scenario where like the whole rest of the world is battling coronavirus. And China is like the one country with closed borders that isn't suffering from it.
Yeah. And I think this is all just part of the deflection mechanisms in the cathedral to direct your ire towards China, as opposed to our own elites, which is where you should be looking. I mean, I just feel nothing but apathy towards China, and it's our own government's fault that so much of our manufacturing is over there in the first place. It's not, you know, the Chinese didn't build the factories first and then make the Americans move their manufacturing there. It's the other way around. So I just see no reason to be directing your energies against China. It's just another big part of the trick being played on people to direct you away from the establishment.
All right, I'm gonna hit the super chats. I'll start off with Entropy. So this is the first time that I've used Entropy because I thought I was demonetized, but there's super chats coming in. I'm like the worst at this in the world. So the one and only Lady Rotha for £60. Thank you very much. In case we never meet again, get yourself some single malt. Take care of yourself and beware of drones. Yeah, I mean, so thanks a lot for that. I mean, the whole drones thing, I got into it before. It's one of the most disgusting things I've seen so far. Because this is the problem that the British people have, is because they know it's not consistent. Because they know the everybody's on the London Underground was packed, and then they're going to do this kind of thing. And it's just the police. The police in this country are total dicks, to be honest. Thanks a lot for that.
It's unbelievable. It's beyond parody.
Yeah, they are. It is this kind of joke. They are like this sort of global homo Stasi. If they were tough but it was consistent, it would be one thing, but we know they're not. And again, these are the inconsistencies which having this pressure on the system reveals, which is these little stories are kind of what I like to take note of, you know.
Would really mean
it's the perfect example of anarcho-tyranny that, you know, they have no interest in policing, you know, the crowds in London cramming themselves into the tube, but they're more than happy to monitor a couple who are the only people within 5 miles of each other out in the middle of nowhere.
And more than happy
you
is really
you
the key.
Make a,
they seem to revel in this.
You know the Squidward meme, I sleep. It's like you know, the first picture, 19,000 British girls being raped by grooming gangs. I sleep. English couple going for a walk in the countryside.
that raises an interesting point, which I'll get into briefly because there's quite a few super chats, which is really nice. But one thing that we can see here is that if nationalists were running the country, what you're seeing, that this state power would have been deployed against these, let's say, unpleasant foreigners who have been committing acts of these atrocities against our people in the country. So when we're talking, Keith takes a lot of shit because he's saying you can see what state power can get done. It reveals what the state is actually capable of. Now, if I was running Britain, all of these powers would be deployed to keeping our people safe. Just for a start, and you can see that the government actually had all of these powers, but it just didn't use them. And even now, it's only really using them because it's worried about the economy tanking. and it being bad for business. Right, so the next one is Unknown California for $3. It just says deport Sargon. I haven't followed Sargon's takes on this. I don't know what he's been saying. I can imagine, but and then we've got Samuel Young. Thank you very much. Greetings from France. What do the panelists think of the most recent round of money printing by the Fed?
At this point, we're basically in a complete farce of an economy where, I mean, the Fed, I've seen representatives of the Fed talk about how they're willing to print infinite money. And now banks, the Fed has set the actual reserve rate for banks at 0%. So banks are no longer really banks, as they don't actually have to store any money in them. So we're in a complete, we're in a total command economy now, where it's all just built on nonsense, really. I mean, it's really disempowering to people like us, because you can't even put your money in the bank and have it safe anymore, because the bank is not obligated to actually perform this service for you. It's
when you said the, is that not the interest rate though? That's not the reserve rate, is it?
No, it is now too. The interest rate is zero and the reserve rate is zero. So banks have now ceased to actually function as what you would think of as a bank.
Yeah, I don't know enough about it to comment on it. I'd say, but
economics isn't my strong. Unknown Californian again for $1, $3. Great stream. Good to see Cool Keith on the show. Would love to see Dave Cullen on in the future. I've watched some of Dave Cullen's videos on this, and I thought he made some good points. Trying to be objective. Which again is really difficult when everybody's got their own theory, and you know what we've been talking about tonight.
It's funny, Dave Cullen really now is the biggest nationalist channel on YouTube. I mean, he's kind of he comes more from the skeptical or maybe the civic nationalist point of view, but I couldn't even say that, because in the last few months he is a full on ethno nationalist now. So he doesn't really get mentioned in national circles, but I mean, he's actually the biggest channel in these circles now. So it's really encouraging to see. And, you know, he has people like E. Michael Jones and people from the National Party on. So that's great.
Yeah, he was in the chat on a stream by Laura Towler with Horace. So I think I'm pretty sure he's on our side.
He comes across as a really decent bloke as well.
Yeah, he is.
Right, so I'll move on to the other ones. Hey, I tell you what, there's a lot. I hope YouTube let us have them, because my channel's on the bad list. Like, a student of history for £2. Thanks a lot. Two people I know are in hospital, empty in both. I'm not sure what that means, but it's two people that he knows are in hospital. I don't know. Last Red Swirls, £5. Thanks a lot. Shrimpy for £10. Thanks a lot. Evening, lads. Hope you're all well and having a good show. We'll listen later. Cheers, Rimmy. Student of history again for £5. This hyperdeflationary collapse will kill far more than the virus if they don't turn the regular economy back on. Cheaper to provide PPE. Yeah, this is what the free market types are saying. More people will die because of the collapse in the economy than because of the virus. But I have to say, we may not like it where the only structures left are these multinationals, but the food panic definitely seems to have sort of dwindled away a bit, and the shelves are, at least in the Northeast, people have stopped complaining, the stockpiling thing. They've got over it by the looks of it.
Yeah, one thing I will say is that this might be unpopular, but yeah, I mean, to be honest, the economy is actually concerning. And I don't mean to sound like, you know, someone who says that, well, it doesn't matter if people die as long as the economy is running. I'm certainly not saying that. But yeah, it definitely is concerning seeing like the amount of layoffs and just seeing the collapse worldwide of the economy. But the problem is this, though, the economy is designed in a way that it would facilitate the spread of a virus like this, because I mean, that's what happens. So you're in a situation where you really can't turn the economy back on, because what that entails is allowing free movement from all of these infected areas to the entirety of the world. That's kind of how we got in this situation in the first place. So, I mean, I'll give people the point that yes, the economy collapsing could actually be more deadly than the virus itself. Who knows? But in order to actually turn the economy back on, that would entail spreading the virus far further, because it's those systems that cause the problem to begin with. So you're kind of stuck in the situation that you have to take that strong arm approach to it, because you can't turn the economy back on because of the way that it's designed.
I mean, there was I saw when you know, a week or two back, when people were sharing pictures of corner shops who are run by, mainly in Britain, by a certain ethnicity, mainly Asians, and there was instances where they were charging like £6 for hand sanitizer, which was worth 60 pence, and a lot of people were complaining about it. And the libertarians came out and they were saying that that's healthy and normal, and when you begin to regulate it, there'll be a shortage. And and what they were saying was that if you just let everybody get on with it, they would be selling it on eBay and the price would settle. What do you make of that, Keith? Because I know they're not your friends.
This might shock you, but I'm not sure I would go against the free market principle. I'm not sure like we should be forcing them to sell it at 99p if people are willing to pay £5 for it.
Oh, so,
shock. I'm in agreement with AA on this one.
Shock. You're with me on this one.
I agree there as well. I mean, the thing is, you don't really need 20 bottles of hand sanitizer. You just need one. But if people are panic buying all of them for dirt cheap, then what happens is people are left without them. So, you know, if you have to pay a little bit more for a brief time, that kind of sucks. But at least then it's spread around in the economy because, you know, people, if it costs 10 times as much, you can't just hoard all of it for yourself. That's kind of the principle in effect here.
All right, we'll move on to the next one. That caught us off guard there. Like, George, £10, illegals might become a threat with no income. That's a good point, actually. So it's not just in Britain as well, but across the West, we've got all of these illegals. And I think they'll probably be, well, he has a conspiracy. He has a black pill conspiracy. If this carries on, they'll sort of fast track all of these illegals through and give them national insurance numbers so that they can start and claim dual without causing too much havoc. So they can have some sort of income. They'll get the Boris books. Joseph for $5, the right needs vision on Lenin and Mao. They are anti-liberal greats and literally made more socially conservative states than the West by the 1950s.
Yeah, I think not.
Yeah,
is that
big against that?
Are we going to go full Mao Ball now? Was it Mao Ball? Dr. Ron Paul for €10. Thanks a lot. Today, actually, Trump invoked the Korean War era Defense Production Act, which allows a president to force companies to make products for national defense. So he forced GM to produce ventilators. Yeah, we got into that earlier. So he's forced them to do it with this new act. Gesture it for £19.99. Thank you very much. No comment. Trooper Investor, £9.99. Is there any chance the EU survives this crisis? Well, I mean, the European Union's response has been pathetic, and we've seen Russia. There was this symbolic thing in Italy where they took down the EU flag somewhere because Putin sent them aid, and the European Union completely failed to help them out. I mean, this was one of those times when you could think, okay, everybody's moaned and complained about the European Union. They had to step up and bat, and they've dropped the ball. It was a bit of a flop by the looks of it.
True. I would say I'm 100% certain the EU is going to survive this, though. I mean, it's definitely going to accelerate its decline, but I don't see coronavirus just taking out the whole thing in one fell swoop.
I saw Italy today, like, sent a warning to the EU basically saying, you know, your response is so terrible and we're finished with you if you don't do something about this. But again, it exposes the thing with the EU, which is that it's powerful in the areas where you don't want it to be powerful, and then it's basically weak and helpless in the areas where it should be powerful. So it's just it's a problematic institution on every level, really.
There was another funny story that came out last week that kind of really puts a dagger in the whole like EU brothership kind of idea. It was that China was trying to send masks from China to Italy, but they had to stop in the Czech Republic first, and the Czech Republic just confiscated them. It was hundreds of thousands of medical masks, and the Czech Republic just said, "No, we're keeping these for ourselves." So, you know, they're kind of in the time of crisis, the whole EU brothership thing kind of goes out the window.
All right. So Nordic Nightmare, £2. We tank the economy for no reason, bro. Thanks a lot, Nordic Nightmare again. The only conspiracy is what did China know and when did they know it? I remember in the early days of this, Red Ice did a great stream about how Bill Gates and all of these globalists were shipping these viruses from Canada over to China or something like that. And it's weird how that does seem to have, those style of conspiracies seem to have drifted away a bit. We've got all new ones which have popped out since. But it was a good case, and it was really interesting. What were they doing shipping all of these viruses all over, and to Wuhan as well? It was just a question that popped up as well. How long before cooping people up like this results in people disobeying en masse? Well, this is going to be where I think this will become a thing, actually. That's why I thought that was an interesting question. How long can they reasonably do this for?
Yeah, that's interesting. One of the interesting things to see is how people are handling this use of force by the government to keep them contained. And I think it's an interesting look at how much discipline modern people have. You know, they can't even do something that's probably to their benefit for even a week without freaking out about it and going stir crazy. And I mean, I understand that it's not really fun to be cooped up, but I think it's kind of, there's kind of a dark humor in just watching how undisciplined modern people are. It's really kind of a black pill.
And also just how little respect they really have for the authority today, because, you know, they had put out that call about a week ago, you know, about 2 weeks ago now, to say everybody stay home, don't go to nightclubs, don't go to these, you know, try to not go on the transport when it's busy and stuff like that. And no one listened. I mean, they actually have to just use strong arm methods to actually get people to obey the authority. I don't know. Would that be the same case in a different era? Would, say, you know, 100 years ago, had they told people that, would they have listened? I do wonder about that.
Well, this is, it's weird because the society, if you look at the rhetoric coming out, it's strange because, and I did a video on this, but they're speaking to Britain of like 1965. They're not speaking to Britain as it is now. I mean, diversity isn't our strength anymore. We are now one coherent, unified nation in the face of this threat. Yeah, that's the exact society which they've set about dismantling over the last few decades. Like, that's exactly what's made us in this weakened situation. It was a matter of policy by the government and then also by all of these corporations to break us down and atomize us and make everybody, even from Thatcher's time, make everybody just out for themselves, this dog-eat-dog world. And then they're just going to try and pretend that none of this happened. And you see that they'll use the NHS as this big symbol to be worshipped that we can all gather around and pray to the NHS.
Yeah, right. Someone asked me in the chat, do I think that's a good thing that people just didn't listen to the authority? And what I'd say is that in a healthy society, if you'd have an authority structure which people would generally respect, and, you know, the authority tells you to do something, people would do it. They'd actually follow the instructions that were handed down from them by an authority that actually was legitimate and was competent. I'd say that people not respecting that, and you know, we of course, all of us here understand the hostile nature of the authority we're under. But I really think it's more just a testament to the kind of incoherent society that they've created. Because I do think that in a healthy society, yes, it would be good for people to generally support authority. But you know, they've, like Morgoth had mentioned, they really have just been working tirelessly to deconstruct that. And you know, at a time of need, when they try to actually turn to that, no one respects it.
Right. We just don't have the social fabric anymore to deal with this sort of thing. People don't care about each other at any level, really, at this point.
I mean, in the old days, you know, you would get there would be a power structure, and it would be, you could say, the unions, it would be the church, it would be the local government. People would know all of their neighbors. There'd be older, like, men. It would be a patriarchy, and you'd have older men with standing and respect in the community. All of that's gone. So eventually you just have to have Boris Johnson going on the BBC telling everybody, I'm sending the police to make you stay indoors, because that's all that's left now is the raw power of the state. It's because that glue that held everything together was deliberately and systematically dissolved over a period of decades.
You know, I know that you have a lot of reservations about World War II and stuff, but you know, I mean, just for a theoretical, do you think, like, during the Blitz, if they had, like, if you know, London was multicultural and stuff, and they said, "Get inside, the Germans are going to be bombing London," do you think anyone would have listened, or do you think they would have just ignored it?
Yeah, but the strange thing is that I've seen actual counter narratives coming out about that and saying there was like 1,400 cases of looting in London, and it's as if they're preparing people for what could lay ahead in a month's time if this carries on. Because in my opinion, and I think most of the opinion of people watching here, London is actually the weakest link, it's as if they're sort of preparing the ground to say, well, you know, there was looting and there was thieving and raping going on during the Blitz, so it's not really any different now. Do you see what I mean?
Oh, so they're trying to actually, like, they're trying to deflect it. They're trying to, like, go ahead and preempt that attack.
That's just like my little theory, but we'll see how that goes. We'll see how that plays out. So Dara McKinney, £10, thank you very much. A few pints for the lads. The two Yanks can buy their own.
I'm not a Yank.
There's only one Yank.
I mean, I would contest that even. I'm in Dixie, so don't call me a bloody Yank.
$5. You touched on this, but what about the Peter Hitchens type appeal to English identity as one which resists arbitrary policing, misguided or worthwhile? So So there is actually quite a backlash in amongst certain English characteristics which cannot stand this, which, you know, this is something which I've spoken about quite a lot, and it's one of those controversial subjects and gets us into all kinds of territory. But just in the case of this, we do see someone like these old conservatives like Peter Hitchens. He's out there alone, really, and at least I can see where he's coming from. The other ones, like Brendan O'Neill and Spiked Online, have the worst takes on this you can ever imagine. Hitchens is being a sort of, as Keith was saying, this in traditional skeptic of power, which is a sort of old English thing. I think in this particular case, the problem you have, what if you're wrong? So what if you're going to play that? You know, leave me alone. I don't want anything to do with the state. I'm not going to be bossed around by the state. And you're in your little English shire and everybody starts to drop dead with the bat flu because you try to be a smart ass. Are you going to be able to live with that? This is the pressure which is being brought to bear on that. I'm just doing what I'm told.
Yeah, I definitely understand his sentiment, though, from what I understand about, I guess, the traditional English mindset in terms of wanting to be left alone for the most part.
But I mean that's
funny enough, that argument you made there, Morgoth, is kind of the same argument Peter Hitchens makes about criminalizing drug use when people say that it's their choice, that, you know, it doesn't matter if it's your choice because your death or illness would affect family members. So you're kind of using, it's funny, you're kind of using the same logic he uses for those kinds of arguments.
And the other thing I do is I question a lot of, I really question when people claim that that individualism is really just so ingrained in the Anglosphere, because I wonder, say, you know, pre-1960s, the government maybe wasn't as powerful, but, you know, if the social structure told you to do something, you generally would do it. I mean, if we want to look at, say, the Victorian era, you know, the hierarchy, you know, they, people followed the rules back then. It's not like they just told authority to go screw itself every time someone tried to enforce some kind of standard on them. So I don't even, maybe you might know a bit more about that than I do, but it just doesn't really seem true on a very factual basis.
It's a big can of worms, because you could say that the class structure was itself a result of that, where people who got ahead moved upwards and you got left with this rigid class structure. But that'll have to be a whole other stream. Right, so we got through Guzzi, and we've got Austrian school, Ubermensch, £5. This money goes towards buying yourself and Keith book on basic economics. Keith, look up Bob Murphy on the issues of MMT and government debt. Fair enough. Thanks a lot. I'm crap with economics, and I know I don't pretend to be otherwise. And then we've got a student of history again for £2. Why would folk want to obey a hostile government? Well, they're not. They're totally. It seems to me they are obeying them, but then sort of being really skeptical on the internet, which is the only outlet people have got because everybody's confined indoors.
I made like a little joke tweet about this sort of thing. It kind of feels like we're living in a demo for when we're all just living in some virtual simulated reality, stuck in some chamber where all interaction with people is just simulated.
When you're in your pod eating your bugs.
Yeah, that's what this is a test run for, really.
And I know it's like really depressing, but I thought like if everybody gets it, like it becomes this really, really serious thing where millions of people are dying from it. It'll be strange because you'll have all of these will Twitter like sort of calm down? Will all of the social media stop? People stop tweeting and uploading to YouTube, and everything will just draw to a close, because what you'll have is all of these avatars all over the internet, but the person behind them will be lying dead, and so it'll just be like these billions of lifeless avatars. that movie with Charlton Heston where he's like the last man alive and he's wandering around in New York, and then you see it all. He's the only person. He's got like a dog and he lives alone for 10 years or something like that. They made a rubbish update with Will Smith. Like going on Twitter will be like that, where you see like one tweet coming down your timeline once a day because everybody's dead.
Imagine if it gets really bad, you can't go to funerals and they just start live streaming the funerals and everyone will be in the chat pressing F.
Yeah, that's right. It's like, because, you know, we talk these days about how everybody kind of lives. It's called the Omega Man, yeah. It'll be like the online Omega Man.
They'll start shadow banning the funerals of nationalists.
You see, because we all say everybody spends too much time on the internet, and you live your life through the internet and all that kind of thing. And so how would that life on the internet would be affected by the real sort of biomass dropping dead in the real world, and the effect it would have would be I'll go on Twitter today and see if anybody tweeted, see if there's anybody else out there. people just like a lonely account. Hello, is anybody out there going on thought trends and things like that to see if there's anybody left alive? Just a happy thought for everybody there. Student of history for £2. Thanks a lot again. Imagine life with permanent social distancing. Yeah. So that's kind of like what we're getting into as well.
It's like the life of most Zoomers, I'd say.
Yeah, it's a lot of people are saying this is just my normal life anyway, all like the millennials and whatnot. But what I have seen, I will say, in the street, because people are off work, and there's like people sitting around in their gardens, and they've got swing balls out, and the kids are out, and people are chatting on. And I've spoken to a few people when I had my hours walk each day. And they're saying, you know, it's actually quite nice. It's like what it was like in the 80s when I was a kid. And people have got this nostalgic feeling because when they were young, it used to be like that. Everybody in the street would know each other and everybody would chat with each other. And there's an element of that coming back as well.
Yeah, I was saying, I was talking about this a little bit before, but I think unironically, I'm kind of enjoying this a lot more than the regular day-to-day.
I mean, you know, we talk about how could nationalists make use of this. What you might see is that if things began to get back to normal, you may see a lot of people who haven't been affected too much, and they're going to think, but I don't want to go back to sitting in the office, especially women. I don't want to go back to sitting in the office and traveling around 10-hour work days and all of that crap. I got used to living on less and having more spare time to learn knitting and reading Catherine Cookson romance novels. And I like it. I don't want to go back. And you could get this thing where they've got to use the state again to get people back to work.
Yeah, I mean, for the last few weeks, I've been doing like a strictly regimented diet and exercise routine, and I'm doing tons of reading and getting work done on videos and such, and you know, I don't have to deal with any of the normal problems of modernity, and it's just kind of great, honestly.
There's some of these girls on Twitter, people were retweeting them, kind of laughing at them. They were like listing out like their 14 mental illnesses, and it's like, oh my God, like, what about me? This is going to affect me so badly. Like, I'm not meant to be like at home in silence or these illnesses come at me. It just kind of highlights, like, if there's one thing that's left out of modern society, it's a place for like contemplation or silence. Everything is any free time is kind of commodified with something, whether it's streaming or YouTube or social media or something. And I don't know, it just kind of highlights that I don't know if it's ever been like that in history before, but there isn't a space in the culture for contemplation or for silence or for being alone, really.
I mean, yeah. For me, I think the weirdest thing that's happened is that it's kind of inverted my willpower. That for me, just on my daily routine, I feel a lot. I feel really lazy when I just stay home. I feel like, you know, I'm wasting time. I should be out there, you know, not being antisocial, actually interacting with other people or exercising or something like that, being productive. But then it's kind of inverted that for me, so that I feel like, you know, I feel guilty for doing that and not staying home. So it's kind of like my urges have been completely like reversed, as in being lazy is what my willpower is trying to force me to do, which is really weird because I've kind of built up, you know, trying to be more active and trying to be more social as being healthy. And that's just been completely inverted in the last week.
Mm. Yeah. Charlamagne. It's interesting though, because I think that is true for me to some extent too. Like normally, like I go to the gym and that's my workout area, and it's easy for me to do that there and not get distracted. So it's actually kind of provided a test for really proving how well your willpower really functions when you're constantly cooped up with all manner of distractions you could indulge yourself in. So it's been really interesting. I think it's been particularly interesting as well that this is happening during Lent as well.
Yeah, it is. This is my takeaway. And I think just to sort of round off the stream, it is there is something to be said for it, where, because especially me and Keith, we talk a lot about people just being on this treadmill and being this consumer unit, and the people don't know anything else. And now by this Black Swan event, you know, it's this thing that's happened, people are being forced to take some time out. And it isn't a time out where you go on the piss to Spain for 2 weeks or whatever, or go and find yourself in India. You have been confined to your home, and you're going to have to take a look at those books which have been gathering dust, or learn how to brew beer and all of these kinds of things. So there is that, and it'll be interesting if it lasts for a while and people firstly get used to living on less, and then also filling in their time with reading and whatever they're doing. And it'll be interesting to see what happens when the system says, okay, the virus is gone, get back in the office and get back into it all. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how they try to put it all back together after this. Because, I mean, are they going to, you know, when they cancel, if this continues into June and they cancel, I don't know, the LGBT Pride Month, are they going to say, well, actually, we're going to have LGBT Pride Month in September because we missed it in June? It's like, how are they going to put the entire system, which has just taken a beating, back together?
Yeah. So Troy for $10 Canadian says the takeaway from much of this stream was that if you question the official narrative regarding COVID, you therefore have an incoherent worldview opposed to fundamental reality. Disappointing for many. That's not my stance on it. I'm just pointing out that there's this tangled web of narratives and take, which just makes a head explode.
Yeah, it's a 90 IQ super chat at best.
That's exactly the message of the stream. Anyone that doesn't believe the mainstream media and everything is an idiot, and Hillary Clinton should be president. That is the message.
Controversial. All right. Any parting shots?
Other than that, no.
I might just get a plug in, actually, although I don't know how well it'll go down after that. But doing a podcast, first show is with Morgoth. I've done one with Borzoi. Cultured Thug will be on next week, and I'll be talking to E. Michael Jones about Hegel sometime next month. So the link for that's on my Twitter and YouTube if anyone wants to subscribe to that.
Yeah, I guess I'll go ahead and link my channel in the chat too, since not everyone here might be familiar with me. I mostly do neo-reactionary stuff, mold bug.
Oh, shit. I've missed one. Yeah, sorry, Charlemagne.
Yeah, go ahead.
Marcus DeLubowitz, greetings from New York City, the epicenter. Hope you're all doing well. Hit me up on Skype, Morgoth. I just saw your message before I went live, and I shut everything down except this. So, yeah, I will. I'll be in touch. Thanks a lot for that. Sorry, Charlemagne. I was going to say, so you can check out Endeavor, Keith, and Charlemagne. They've all got great YouTube channels. I forgot to put it into the information. I'm overwhelmed with all this stuff.
Yeah, I'm getting
you've
close
got
to,
almost as many live viewers as Sergen, actually. Sergen's on around 2,000, and you have like 1,400, so not bad.
I would say, Endeavor has a pretty good Discord going, NRX files, and we've got a lot of new and, I guess, up-and-coming YouTubers in there, like Closington, Anamnesis, Settler's Lament, a few other people that you might be familiar with. And they've been putting out some pretty good videos as well. So if you want to hang out, that's a good place to be.
Yeah, all right, we have a good community. And, hey, I'm almost at 10,000, so it'd be a good time to subscribe to me. But other than that, I'd say... keep yourself sane during the lockdown when you're stuck in your room. Don't spend all day on Twitter, you know, trying to decipher, you know, whether it's a conspiracy theory or whether the world is going to end. Just, you know, maybe read a book, develop a skill of some kind, find something to keep you sane, because that's what you're going to need, I think.
Actually, last night in the Discord, we had some fun live streaming Zulu with each other, and that was pretty fun.
All right,
I love that movie. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah, it would be an interesting one to analyze and do just a stream on Zulu. Actually,
I'd definitely love to do that.
Dawn Browning for Australian $20 breakfast pick to follow. I don't know what that means, but thanks a lot for the super chat. And I think I'll leave that. I've been a little bit low energy this stream, but I think I'll do another one soon. Everyone's at home. I might do another one soon. I'll be a bit more high energy. And we'll do another stream soon, I think, but not on the corona virus. We could do one on movies. Zulu would be a good one, actually. Yeah. I'd enjoy to do that one. I think there's a lot to get into there. Being careful, of course, because of the subject matter. I think I'll be able to leave this stream up on my channel. But usually, I mean, if we did Zulu, and we you do an analysis of Zulu, it's probably going to have to go on BitChute after. But, we've got another one. Yeah, thanks a lot. It's great, this. Like, I'm thoroughly enjoying the time at home with the kids and not having to work. It will be worth a video about the beauty of this time. Yeah, I mean, I'm not much of an indoorsy type, but it is nice to get off a treadmill, I've got to say. So thanks for tuning in, everybody. And I think we'll do another stream soon on non-corona related stuff. So I'll catch you all later.